we need a new open for it, because now we have 75 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
You're right. Do you have any ideas for what you would want to say? Do we have a catchphrase?
Do we have a catchphrase? I don't know. Catchphrase? Don't quit.
Thank you for coming back once again to the Quick Restart. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quinn Kesnick as always. And Quinn, what a week three it was. I think when you are listening to this, we will have a new number one team in the Maverick media poll. I don't know for sure just yet who it will be, but my suspicion is that it's going to be the Yale Bulldogs, who are emerging off of a 12-10 win at Panzer Stadium, a capacity Panzer Stadium in Penn State, where, I mean, once again, it was the Yale Bulldogs taking it to the Nittany Lions. They've now played three times in the last 2 years, and Yale has emerged victorious all three times. But an incredible defensive effort, holding the Penn State offense to 10 goals for the first time since 2018.
There was a lot of important games this weekend, but you got to start at Panzer Stadium. Number one, the crowd was awesome. The weather was good. I got to watch a lot of the game this morning on Sunday morning as I was working opposite that game yesterday. And what stood out to me was Yale's athletic middies beating their man and scoring some unassisted goals. I thought the key in the game, obviously Yale has the possession advantage with T.D. Irwin, and that's body shots. You know, that's time of possession. They also won the ground ball battle. But Yale's ability to beat the man off the dodge and score, I just counted maybe five or six goals that Penn State gave up in that game that were a late slide, no slide, or a bad rotation after a slide. Just fundamental breakdowns in defensive execution. And Yale's too good to screw that kind of stuff up. You know, this game featured a ton of turnovers. Yale couldn't clear the ball. It was an ugly clearing effort, and Yale had trouble at times with picks behind the goal. But these two teams went toe-to-toe. I give them both credit. I think they both moved forward off this game. And they're certainly, watching the tape, there was no reason for me to believe that these aren't two of the top five or six teams in the country. I'm coming back with Yale at one, and I'm leaving Penn State at three.
So I'm going to do you one better. I've had Yale one since the beginning of the season, and I'm going to have Penn State at two. You know, obviously losing a game at home, not necessarily the mark of the second best team in the country, but at the same time, you know, I thought that this was not only a game in which they went toe-to-toe with the team that I have thought was the best team in the country, but also, you know, they got better as the game went along. And what was interesting, I had the same reaction in terms of the athleticism of Yale's midfielders. You had spoken about Christian Kropp and how, you know, he was a guy that had been on your radar dating back. This was the first time I'd seen Logan Solberg, and I thought that the broadcast did a really nice job of pointing it out with him in the number two jersey and Thomas Bragg in the number 45 jersey. It was like watching Ben Reeves and Jason Alessi all over again. These guys are monsters. And even though they aren't necessarily filling the same roles as their predecessors, they certainly look the part.
Yes.
But the two things that jumped out to me the most were the sloppiness. And it was really, it's hard to call it exclusively sloppy, because for as many, I think, I'm pretty sure Yale went 2 of 6 clearing the ball, and maybe even 2 of 8 in the first quarter.
They had 11 failed clears at the end of the day. 11. I mean, without their possession advantage at the faceoff X, they probably lose that game just because of their clearing.
Right. But number one, Mac O'Keefe, like, I mean, he looked like Rick Beardsley with his ability to, like, place these pinpoint checks and knock the ball out of, you know, ball carrier sticks as they were clearing. Now, that being said, it also looked like frequently the guys clearing the ball weren't running at full speed. It was this weird combination of intensity, but also figuring out how this game was going to unfold, particularly early. And then the other thing that stood out to me was it didn't really seem like Grant Ament was that involved in the first half. And I didn't know what to attribute that to, because, you know, even though Chris Fake has been a guy who's played him well, it felt like when he asserted himself in the second half, nothing changed. There was no material change that allowed him to assert himself. It was as if he had flipped a switch and made the decision that now is the time to press, and he was incredibly effective, particularly in that, like, late third, early fourth quarter stretch where they brought the game back to a one-goal affair.
Yeah, going back to O'Keefe and the riding, I mean, I know when I played, there are certain attackmen that you knew you don't want to let them get close to you without releasing the ball, because they knew where to check. They could get their stick in the passing lane and pick one off, especially the Canadians in and around the crease. And O'Keefe looks to be that guy. He's got really good range. And he got to defenders' butt ends in their hands, and that one play, that one just blatant steal was brilliant. So, you know, beware of that, because there's a lot of defenders who think they're so strong that they can withstand the attackman on their elbow or on their glove. I don't think O'Keefe's the guy you want to mess with. But you know, at the end of the day, Yale's defense was pretty darn good. I mean, you hold Penn State to well below their scoring average over the past 2 years. True. I mean, they're averaging what, 16, 17, 18 goals a game.
No doubt.
They barely got to double digits. The game thing situation is weird. I thought Chris Fake played well. When Amen had some success late in the game, it was really because of miscommunication on those picks that I mentioned at X. Midfielders getting in Fake's way, midfielders doubling when they shouldn't have. It looks like Chris was perfectly content to match feats with Grant. And I wonder, you know, obviously I saw Grant and he was on a scooter in November. I'm wondering if he is truly back to the cutting ability that he once had. We'll see. You know, I compare him to a guy like Michael Sowers or Chris Gray, and those guys are cutting a little faster right now, I think, than Grant is.
One more thing I wanted to touch on in this game. Colby Knies made 16 saves for Penn State. Brody Wilson made 8 and let in 10. Not the best stat line, but I was really impressed by Wilson's performance. I thought he stole a couple, including, I think, he had a one-on-one, I want to say, with a man in transition where he just stopped him down low. He thought the ball had gotten past him, but it was a nice save. Did you take anything away from the goalie play? And more specifically, what do you make of Yale, you know, having a two-year starter, national championship winning goalie in Jack Starr, and making the decision to go with a first-time starter in Wilson now for the second consecutive game?
Yeah. Is Starr healthy? Wilson's got a lot of playing time in his career, though, and so I think there's good trust there. You know, the one thing, if I'm Penn State, I got to look at these Yale Dodgers. They're really downhill. They're north-south guys. Bragg, you mentioned Solberg right down the right alley, Kotler down the left alley. Really, the only shifty middy they have in my eyes is Tevlin. He didn't have a superb shooting day on Saturday. But I go back to Virginia in the national final game. The way they were able to turn, you got to turn these Yale midfielders and make them play east-west. Because once they get their hips and shoulders going downhill, you got problems. And that was really what I saw from Penn State's short stick defense. They left those guys on islands. They got run by too often, or the Yale player got to his strong hand with good momentum, eyes up where he could see the slide coming or not coming, eyes up to where he could feed the crease. I thought that was the difference, really the main difference in this game.
Well, a lot more to unpack as we move forward with both Penn State and Yale this season, but we want to turn our attention to Charlottesville, where the Princeton Tigers emerged 16-12 victors over the Virginia Cavaliers, knocking off the number 2 team in the country, as well as the defending national champions. For Princeton, there's no question that this was a long time coming, a big signature statement win for Coach Matt Matalon. They were led, of course, by Michael Sowers, who you mentioned is just playing out of his mind right now. He had 4 goals and 4 assists. He's averaging 11 points in Princeton's 3-0 start, 11 points per game. And his change of direction, his explosiveness, his roll dodging, I mean, everything about his ability to get to space and get hands free, his ability to play picks, his ability to throw assist passes that defenses aren't expecting, all of it is just so top-notch right now.
Yeah, congratulations to Princeton. As you said, it's been a long time since Princeton won a big game. I mean, let's be honest. Michael Sowers has been operating in anonymity basically in the last 2 years. They have not been able to beat a top-ranked opponent. They've come close to Virginia last year, a game they should have won. But so this is a turning point for this program. We know what Sowers can do. I wrote about him exclusively in my poll for Monday. But it's the other guys now playing off him, to me, that make the difference. Connor McCarthy, Chris Brown, Alex Slusher looked really good. So the other parts are more than complimentary. This is an offense in the Ivy League, which had another spectacular weekend. This is a legit offense, and I thought their goalie, Eric Peters, maybe was the difference maker, making all sorts of low stops, especially early in the game.
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't paying as close of attention early in the game as I was later because of the focus that I had given to Penn State Yale was going on concurrently. And so when I really did kind of redirect my focus, and Matt Ward and Paul Carcaterra started talking about and showed a reel of Peters' saves, it was no question. I was like, like, oh, wow, this was a game that had the opportunity to get out of hand early because of the onslaught of Virginia's offense. And Peters kept him in it. I believe he had six saves in the first quarter. He finished with 16 in the afternoon at 60% overall. And I agree with you. Chris Brown, to me, is just another level athlete. And it's funny because having watched Princeton play a handful of times last year, I kept walking away with the same impression, which is that, you know, getting off the bus, they look like a bona fide top 10 team. But
no, when I put the tape in, Terry, I couldn't tell who was in white and who was in black and orange. Totally. I was like, wait a second, is Virginia wearing orange or is Princeton in white? And so that's a credit. And, you know, I asked myself today, I'm shopping at Wegmans. And the thing I'm thinking about, this Ivy League, this revival, you know, we saw some of it last year. It looks like it's even stronger this year. How did this happen? You know? And maybe it's early recruiting, because I know teams like North Carolina and Johns Hopkins are suffering because of early recruiting. I know Virginia won a title last year with a lot of early recruits, but I'm wondering if some of those high profile athletes somehow ended up in the Ivy League because of early recruiting. It's worth a thought. I'd be interested in your opinion and Ty's opinion on that.
Yeah.
Well, the athletic profile of these Ivy League teams has skyrocketed in the last 5 years.
I would agree, and I'll come back to that, because I was able to watch Cornell's really, really impressive one-sided win over High Point on Sunday in person, and came away with, you know, kind of two distinct conclusions as far as the general athletic profile of their team, but we'll get to that in a minute. But before moving off specifically of Brown, you know, it's unfair to put this, I don't know, reaction or opinion on any individual player, but it seemed to me last year, like, and this was probably even more true at the defensive end of the field, the big athletic players for Princeton weren't the guys that were the productive players. They weren't the ones that were making the plays. And I felt like against Virginia, that was not the case. The guys that were winning the athletic matchups were also being productive. And it wasn't, you know, just the highlight reel corner snipes and those types of things. It was the 50-50 ground balls in the middle of the field and getting them the extra possessions. You know, this wasn't a game that was decided by a one-sided face-off battle either. It was really, it felt so much like a bona fide toe-to-toe victory in which Princeton looked at the defending champs and said, we can play you straight up and beat you on your home field. And if you're Matt Medelon and the rest of that group, you have to feel incredibly good about the confidence that you can derive from that going forward.
I think that point is right on. You know, you think about the Princeton dynasty, and then Cornell had their run with Rob Pinnell, and other teams in the Ivy League just didn't have the athletes. And what we saw last year, Penn stand toe-to-toe with anybody. Yale, maybe the most athletic team in the country now. Cornell improving that direction. Princeton, same thing, what you noticed. What I loved about the way they used Michael Sowers in this game was that it wasn't a steady diet of him at X. He dodged from goal line extended. He dodged from the high wing. He even carried the ball up top some. I love that. I think that keeps the defense guessing. It changes angles, changes responsibilities. It didn't feel like it was ever the same look twice. So their new offensive coordinator deserves a lot of credit. And I think that strategy just makes it a nightmare. Like Johns Hopkins has to play Princeton next week. You know, how do you deal with Sowers? Well, every scenario is going to be different, whether he's behind the goal wing or high wing or even from up top. So I give them a lot of credit schematically for keeping it varied.
You just gave me three different ways to segue to North Carolina's win over Johns Hopkins. The early recruiting. Obviously, we had a battle of the two kind of foremost leaders in early recruiting. B, the fact that Princeton takes on the Blue Jays next. And C, this notion, and I want to include Grant Ament in this as well, this notion of ex-attackman, your kind of prototypical bona fide ex-attackman playing in non-conventional spaces on the field. You know, we saw, particularly when he was effective in the second half, Ament was doing so much of his work from that high righty wing, which we saw, you know, at the end of last year was really an effective spot, particularly for his ability to throw multi-angle feeding passes to guys in dangerous shooting and scoring positions. And I really thought that we saw a lot of that out of Chris Gray in the Tar Heels win over the Blue Jays. Gray was once again tremendous for the Tar Heels, but you called this game. What did you see?
I saw a Carolina offense that continues to be really scary because of depth and because of good team speed and the ability to pass and or dodge. They've got strong shooters, lefty-righty combinations. There's a little bit of everything. you know, Gray, Solomon, and Cameron on attack. The first midfield is as good as any, you know, Perry, Anderson, and Cook. I would rate up with Cuse's midfield of Trimboli, Dordovic, and Curry, who played so well on Sunday against Army. And then you go to the second group, and there's about six guys there. You know, O'Connell, Schertzingers, Nicholas, and Gavin. They were quiet in this game, but they give you quality minutes. They're not shooting the ball well right now. And off the bench, you got Alex Trippi, Lance Tillman, and even Jacob Kelly, who had multiple points in this game. So there's a lot there. And keep in mind that this group is under the tutelage of Dave Metzbauer. So you couldn't have a better offensive coordinator. I love their spacing, the way they share it. At times, I felt guys might have gotten a little selfish, but that's fine. You know, Tanner Cook he's a high-volume shooter. He needs his look. William Perry's not bashful from distance. Anderson is a supreme athlete. The kid can do a little bit of everything. He can score on the inside. He can score from the wing. He can play defense. Solomon's learned to play off of Gray, and you know, this Chris Gray performance was unlike any I've ever seen from him. If you label him as a pass first guy, you got to take a second look, because he was hitting mid to outside shots. Such a fast release. You know, I hated that as a goalie. Guys who could get that ball from cradle to shot quickly. It's not an extended long windup. And he had an amazing shooting day. So offensively, Carolina's got it rolling. And this group will continue to score as long as they're fed the ball.
So you mentioned Gray kind of inverting his typical stat line, 8 goals and an assist in the 17-10 win over Hopkins. How much of that do you feel like had anything to do with what the Blue Jays wanted to see him do, what they gave that Tar Heel offense, versus was he just feeling it?
I just think they scouted him as a passer. And, you know, on Friday I watched him practice, and they do a lot of extra man down on Fridays. And I couldn't have been more impressed with what I saw from that offensive group. The ball movement was just lightning. The spacing was good. Multiple threats. And Gray was up top. And there was a time in practice where the defensive rotation got a little soft on him. He stepped into 12 and ripped a corner. So he's got more range. He's strong. He's got a lot more range than people give him credit for. And, you know, that transfer right now is one of the headlines of the early season. I mean, he did a Joe Burrow imitation on Saturday, basically controlling that game. Ground ball play with three guys on him, squirted through and made the assist. Keeping it pretty simple. Couple turnovers, but he's keeping it simple. And there's comfort there. I just sense when Carolina has the ball, they can play fast, they can play slow. There's a lot of options. So they're going to be a dangerous team. The defense needs to get better. I saw signs of them getting better against Johns Hopkins, but that still remains a question mark.
Couple of the results I want to quickly work through. One that was 0-0, Navy versus Maryland was postponed due to a norovirus outbreak among the Navy lacrosse team. Really tragic situation at the Naval Academy that included, I believe, the death of two midshipmen in recent days, including one on Friday night.
My question there, Terry, is Patriot League play starts this week. The Mountain Hawks of Lehigh are supposed to play Navy in the opener. What will the status of that game be?
Certainly one to keep your eye on, and we will do our best to stay apprised of that. Check out InsideLacrosse.com for more developments. And then another game that I didn't have an opportunity, I'm not sure whether you've seen anything from the game, but the Penn Quakers 14, Duke Blue Devils 11. I believe this was from Matthews, North Carolina. And to my knowledge, this game was not streamed. That was a game, however, that was tied, I believe, at 6, 7, 8, and 10 before the Blue Devils took an 11-10 lead. I believe Quakers scored the last 4 goals of the game to secure that 14-11 win. They're playing without sophomore All-American Sam Hanley, who we reported this week sustained an internal organ injury. His return is undetermined at this point. They were led by Sean Lully's 6 goals and an assist.
Yeah, I'm continually looking for highlights of this game that I cannot find yet. The first thing that jumps out is obviously best wishes to Sam and the Penn lacrosse family on his health and his quick return. But given the loss of your best player, given the fact that you were coming off just a collapse against Maryland, you know, the chips are down, you know, all the tides are going against the Penn Quakers. But I give that team, man, they showed so much mental toughness last year. They showed great leadership. Coach Murphy and the staff there, and I think the seniors do a great job. So this win is as big as any in the country, okay, because what they were up against. Everybody said they couldn't beat Duke without Handley. Well, they did, and they finished with authority, which reverses a trend from that Terps game. So I give them credit. They forced a bunch of Duke turnovers. Duke's first midfield did not register a point by the box score. Now Duke's playing a zillion people. They got good production out of some other guys, Caputo, Bedore, et cetera. But it's a giant win. I mean, that is a giant win from the Ivy League. And suddenly Duke now has two losses, and it's only February. They still have the tough ACCs. You're looking at a three or four or more lost season potentially, which means you're probably not going to get a home game. It's going to be tough to be in the top eight with a record like that.
Loyola 11, Rutgers 10. This was a game that went down to the wire. Really interesting stat line insofar as I believe the Greyhounds lost just two faceoffs as Bailey Savio was dominant throughout the game. Also featured a pair of brothers kind of living on a knife's edge at either end. Brennan Kamish scored the game-tying goal for the Scarlet Knights, only to have Joey Kamish, who I believe finished with three goals, score the eventual game winner for the Greyhounds.
Yeah, you know, I watched more of the Loyola Johns Hopkins game from last week and as my prep this week. And there was something about that game that I didn't like. It just didn't smell like an elite level game. And Loyola was patting themselves on the back for beating their local rival, which they should. They've beaten Hopkins now 6 of 7 years. But beating Hopkins, you know, who looks like a non-top 20 team, is not exactly what it used to be. So I don't want to be, you know, a downer, but I was not that impressed. And they played in spurts against Rutgers, got off to a great start, 7-3 lead, and nearly gave the game away. To squander that kind of faceoff percentage from Bailey Savio, who's great, he had 18 grounders, would have been catastrophic. Ryan McNulty again scored in transition, still looking for some midfield offense, again out of Loyola. The one thing I will say about Loyola, and I write about it in my column this week, is, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not sure they'll ever be a great offensive team. But they could be a great defensive team when they get healthy. It is feasible. It is probable that with their coaching and the personnel they have, that they'll be one of the better defensive teams in the country. So winning a game 9-8, 10-9, this one was a little more high scoring than that. But that may be the formula for them. And that's doable. Okay. I just don't think this is the type of offense that's going to put up 12-14 against quality opponents on a weekly basis.
Well, they'll have another local rival that'll be able to see them in action against Towson.
Yeah, Wednesday.
Midweek this week.
Rainy and cold for that one on Wednesday night.
Well, isn't it always? Three more results from Saturday that I want to get to before turning our attention to what I think was the biggest Sunday of the season so far. Merrimack 14, Michigan 12. It was the Warriors' first Division I win.
Yeah, congratulations to the Warriors. Congratulations to Jerry Byrne, the Minister of Defense.
Hey, come on. I'm working in progress here, my man.
I'm off the grid, man. I'm going rogue on you. No, that's a nice win by Merrimack, and I got to wonder what's going on in Michigan. It's a young team. They've had some injuries. The Big Ten, once again, just another brutal weekend from the Big Ten.
As you mentioned, Harvard 10, UMass 9, the Crimson were the last team to play their first game of the 2020 season. They headed out to Amherst, and Jerry Byrne took care of business at a place that he knows very well. Kyle Mullen was a star in this game. I believe he stopped 11 of the first 12 shots that he saw as the Crimson built a 6-1 lead early and then held on despite a Minuteman comeback late.
Jerry's going to have a lot of success there. If the administration supports it, like I think they will, there's no reason to think that in a couple of years he's not going to be challenging for Ivy League titles. You know, I think I've told you this. The hardest phone call I ever had in my life was saying no to Harvard. And I remember hanging up the phone saying, God, that may have just been the biggest mistake you've made so far in your life.
And then the last one that's jumped out to me, Cleveland State 12, Air Force 11, this at Denver as part of the Face-Off Classic event. And both teams then reciprocate and play their other opponents on Sunday. This was a game that I believe had seven goals that were waved off after going in, either for crease violations, moving screens, and the like. It was also a penalty fest. It went to overtime. Tristan Hanna led the Vikings with seven goals. It was the Vikings' first win of the season and the first win for Andy German as a head coach.
They're your squad. They are definitely your squad. And, you know, it bumps Air Force out of the top 20, and it makes it really hard. My poll is pretty difficult when you get around the 18, 19, 20 range, because I'm looking at teams. I mean, I got a list of about 12 teams to me that are all about the same that could go in those spots. You know, Lehigh, Hobart's off to a wicked start. You know, how good is Ohio State, Bucknell, Marist and St. Joe's? You have to give them credit for their wins over Delaware and Army, don't you?
Absolutely.
And then Harvard, starts off with a nice win. So it's really difficult. I found the poll this week to be excruciating. I think watching Albany tape, I think when they figure out their defense, they're going to be a little better this year as well. So good luck for those media folks who have to fill out their polls this week, because it's as hard as it gets. I mean, what do you do with Delaware off that one loss? I still think they're potentially to win their league. It's just difficult. It's not easy this time of year. We're still learning so much about these teams, which is why it's fun and fascinating.
Turning the attention to Sunday, Notre Dame 13, Richmond 5 from South Bend. The Irish moved to 2-0 on the strength of 4 goals and an assist from Pat Cavanaugh, 3 goals and an assist from Griffin Westland.
One of the more impressive result lines of the week, quite frankly. I have Richmond next Friday, ACC Network at Duke. So I watched a lot of Richmond this week. I had a slow week, so I got to watch a lot of tape, which was kind of nice. Richmond's offense is very skillful. Great passing, good finishers. Richie Connell, this freshman they got from the Hill Academy via Colorado, scoring a lot of goals. Lanchberry, Dunn, Savaka, Schultz. It's a good group. So for Notre Dame to stifle them that way, Notre Dame's got to be in the top five. I think I'm going to put them maybe even in the 3 or 4 spot, because they're a team that can beat you two ways, with offense and with defense. And that's a rarity, it seems like, this year.
Not to mention the impressive showing of holding the Spiders' offense to 5 goals. But how about the fact that they put up 13 and Jack Rustbolt made 22 saves? It seems like this is a game that offensively could have gone even more in the Fighting Irish's favor.
No, that exactly. I mean, emphatically stating their case to be a complete team in a daunting league with a tough schedule. Notre Dame plays them all. They got a brutal schedule. So this is a good start. It's a good start considering that you lost your defensive coordinator. It's a good start offensively as well. The scoring seems to be pretty balanced. They got a lot of athletes on that team. They can go a little deeper than usual from what we saw last year with the freshman class. So I like Notre Dame a lot, and I can't wait to see them later on in March.
Keeping with the theme of great goalie play, and particularly goalie play early that helped the game from getting out of hand, Army jumped out to a 3-1 lead on Syracuse, but the Orange used a really nice second-half comeback to secure a 9-7 victory in the Carrier Dome. Jamie Giamboli finished with 5 goals. Drake Porter made 18 saves while allowing 7. His opposite number, Wyatt Shupler, who we talked about last week, made 16 saves. And now Army, after having gotten off to a really, really hot start, falls to 3-2 after its midweek loss to Marist.
Yeah, I watched that game live, actually, online. Thank you guys for sending that tweet out, because when I saw it, I'm like, oh, I'm home. It's a Tuesday afternoon. I can go watch this game. And I watched it. Man, Marist. Red Foxes, man, you guys deserve a lot of credit. They fought so hard for every ground ball. They made shots late in the shot clock. You wouldn't have known if they were red and white Cornell or red and white Marist. That's how good they were. And it just goes to show how on a Tuesday, if you're not ready to rock and roll, you're going to get stung. But Drake Porter was outstanding today. One thing that stands out about the Cuse win, the negative, is that the attack really didn't do much. The attack's dodging ability, I'm kind of questioning. Tromboli, Dordovic, and Curry are everything for that group in terms of initiating and drawing slides and getting the ball in motion. So they just don't have much of a get the ball behind the goal, beat your man type step down looks. That's a work in progress. A very talented Cuse team. They got to be in everybody's top four.
And the last game I want to talk about this week, Cornell 21, High Point 11. This game was played at Calvert Hall High School in Baltimore, Maryland. And, I mean, you want to talk about an attack unit that can keep teams on its heels. John Piatelli, 6 goals. Jeff Teat, 3 goals and 4 assists. Michael Long, the freshman, Under Armour All-American, number 9 ranked player in Inside the Crosses, class of 2019, 4 goals and 3 assists. And I want to focus on Long to start, because he was a player who, in Cornell's season opening win over Albany, was held scoreless and committed 3 turnovers, which, you know, there are a couple of notable players in college lacrosse who we've seen that kind of spell the end of their season. Not so. He ended up putting up 4 goals and an assist in Friday's win over Towson, and then comes back and puts up a 7-point day against High Point. And, I mean, there is so much that you can say about this Cornell offense. The ball movement keeps defenses on their heels. It makes it really difficult to get out and press on their hands. But when you combine the midfielder's ability to just attack anybody, right? Like they, it doesn't matter who has the long pole. They can kind of cycle through. And I think Cooper Telesco running with Jonathan Donville and Connor Fletcher gives a new element to this big red offense. And so their top six is so, so dangerous. And it really felt like they could kind of name the score in this one against the Panthers.
Terrific pair of wins, you know, Friday, Sunday, doubleheaders, never easy. They didn't miss a beat on Sunday, being a pretty good high point team that you can watch on Tuesday night at Virginia. I believe it's ESPNU at 5 o'clock. But what I liked about watching the Big Red in their Albany win was the kind of the diversified skill sets of their top six or seven offensive players. Okay, we know Jeff Teat. Donville's just a wicked step-down shooter. He's got a game sense that few midfielders can match. Piatelli, more of a slasher from that right-handed wing. Fletcher, big-bodied, roll you up, you know, run over you, nail the outside shot with his feet set. Telesco, he's like a running back with a lacrosse stick. Lichardi, small little squirty guy who gets underneath you and you got to have a quick change of direction. Lombardi, who's now a sophomore, I believe, he's making contributions. So I love the fact that they've got six or seven guys with entirely different skill sets operating. Now, questions going forward would be defense. That was the issue last year. Faceoffs, looks like maybe they've solved that problem. And you add up those possessions last year. Cornell had to play all sorts of extra defensive possessions, led to a lot of penalties as well. They clean up the faceoff department. Man, this is a dangerous, dangerous team. They'll play Ohio State on Sunday at noon on ESPNU. Jay Alter and Kark have that call. So that's a good look for fans who haven't seen Ohio State or Cornell Sunday, next Sunday, noon, ESPNU.
This is a Big Red team that it feels like has been flying under the radar a little bit. And I think it's a combination of the fact that they, you know, fell beneath expectations last year. You've already talked about this, but between that, the fact that, you know, the Ivy League starts 2 weeks later, their game against Albany didn't have the same level of notoriety that it would have had in prior years because of what Albany was last season. Here they are, you know, now they are 9 days removed from having played their first game of the season, and boom, they're 3-0. And it kind of feels like their season has gone from 0 to 60. You know, as you mentioned, that changes with the national spotlight game against Ohio State, and then the following week they take on Penn State as well. So it will start to ramp up here. But I want to speak specifically about the 2 points that you addressed, one relative to faceoffs. One of the things that stood out to me in this game was that they won 24-35 overall. Four different guys took faceoffs, which, you know, this third and fourth guy is probably a function of the lopsided score. But they were really, you know, pretty liberal between Paul Racimowicz and Angelo Petrakis throughout the game. It was kind of like a two-thirds, one-third distribution, which to me, and I'm going to look a little bit more into this week, but that feels like a relatively uncommon approach for a team that is otherwise good at facing off. You know, this isn't a horrible facing off team at a high point. So that's something to continue to monitor as you go forward. Like you said, it feels like a stone might have been turned for the
Big Red. And a big stone, because it gives their defense a breather. And, you know, I go back to last year. Maybe we had high expectations. Maybe our preseason was a little too high considering some of the defensive losses from the prior year. But you watch them in person, and it was just like they didn't get enough possessions last year. They fell behind in games. They're playing all sorts of defense. The goalie situation didn't iron itself out until Erlen became the starter midway through the year. So that's improved. Faceoffs have improved. And then when you're playing less possessions defensively, you're just going to get better. So there's a bright future for this Cornell team. So, and I think their fans understand that. I think these players understand that. They're in a good spot right now. In a league that's going to be brutally difficult and a lot of fun.
I want to make one more point about Cornell's defense, and that's Gavin Adler, a sophomore defenseman who guarded Asher Nolting in this game. Nolting was limited to a goal and three assists. Adler is 5'8", 180 pounds, and he doesn't look that big, to be honest. And so he was given up probably close to 50 pounds to Nolting, and it was Nolting got him once on an inside roll on a restart from X when the game was already totally out of hand. It was probably 11-5 or so at that point. And just another example of one of these short, low center of gravity, really strong bulldogs, you know, a BJ Grill type player who get undercounted, underestimated at, you know, pretty much every point throughout their career, and then yield production. And talking with Coach Pete Milliman afterwards, you know, he attributed the success that Adler had against Nolting on Sunday to similar to the success that Adler had guarding Tohoku Nanacoke the week prior and Johnny Mazza against Towson. And it was basically just, he's just constantly there and he annoys you and he makes you not want to play the game because he's constantly breathing on you. And it's just something to be mindful of as you turn the attention to Jack Myers and Grant Dement and Jackson Worrell and all these other big matchups that Cornell's going to have to figure out how they're going to approach over the course of the next month.
Look, there continues to be a place for the little guy in lacrosse. If you can move your feet, if you can have a great mind, if you can be a step ahead of the game, if you really understand the game. I mean, look at Cam Macri, who's playing close defense for North Carolina right now. He started his career as a D middy. They moved him to pole, and now he's really the hub of that defense. He played a great game against Johns Hopkins. I mean, he's barely 5'7". He was closing out on shots. He was making the right slides. He's a captain. Very impressed. And then offensively, you know, Chris Gray, Grant Damon, Michael Sowers. I can look them all in the eye, Terry. They're all 5'8 or shorter. Okay. So these coaches who are looking at 6'4, 200 pounders exclusively, you know, height is the least of the qualities that you should be judging a student athlete from at the high school level.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Hopefully inspiration for all those listeners out there hoping to make their mark at the next level.
Who are challenged in that department like I am. Yeah, big week, Foy. Big week. I just want to get one more mention. Tuesday night, ESPNU, High Point, Virginia. Remember, the Panthers beat them last year. It's 5 o'clock on the U. Friday, Richmond at Duke. See how Duke bounces back. And then Sunday, Kark and Jay Alter have that Cornell-Ohio State game. So three real quality games for fans to get a taste for some teams maybe they don't get to see every day of the week.
What a lineup on ESPNU. We are in it, Quint. It's going to be great. Can't wait to talk to you next week.
Yeah, read my poll. Have a great Monday, everybody. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.